Hello, thank you for joining us for what should be a great game.
And fighting is there! Robbie Brady!
The fourth official couldn't allow him on because the fourth official never had a cheat.
Well, he never heated up the baby, did he? Unless he's breastfeeding, he should be all right.
Hello and welcome to the Football Family, the 42's dedicated football podcast. I'm your host, David Snaid, and joining me as always are Gavin Cooney and Shane Keegan. The week that was shone a light on the challenges to shape the future of Irish football, as well as the immediate risk to the credibility of those trusted with overseeing this change. We will discuss the Player Pathways Plan and the FAI's appearance in front of the Public Accounts Committee, one that will live long in the memory for what was redacted rather than any form of redemption. Well, Stephen Kenny gave his first interview since leaving the Ireland job after sitting down with the Irish Independence, Daniel McDonnell. On the pitch, the second week of the League of Ireland Premier Division season saw Shelbourne beat Shamrock Rovers. I was there to watch Will Jarvis and Mark Coyle produce a moment of magic and spoke to Damien Duff afterwards about the Berbatov effect that Jarvis was having at Talca Park. Bowes beat St Pat's 1-0 in a game that was overshadowed at Richmond Park by disorder with pyrotechnics and could lead to a stadium ban for Bowes away fans, as well as a hefty fine for the Saints. Waterford battered Drogheda 4-1, with Padraig Amond ending his 13-year League of Ireland drought, while Galway United were too strong for Dundalk, winning 2-0 at Oriel, and Sligo and Derry played out a Stanley on Saturday. Across the water, Adameda scored two superb goals after coming off the bench at half-time for Celtic, securing a vital turnaround victory away to Motherwell that keeps Celtic 2 points off leaders Rangers, while Brighton boss Roberto De Zerbi voiced some concerns about Evan Ferguson that we will chat about. But there is only one place to start.
In extra time, it's been clutch kicks against the blue £1 billion bottle jobs.
Well, Gav, Gary Neville has another moment possibly going to go down in infamy rather than just him screeching. But is it as simple as that? Are Chelsea bottle jobs, considering Quirin Kelleher was the man of the match in 90 minutes?
It's such a great line, isn't it? All the hard work of pre-rehearsed lines and alliterative and alliteration by Peter Drury, and then he sees Neville just come up with the line to define the cup final. It must be so annoying for him. I think there is definitely a grain of truth to what Neville said, to be honest. Chelsea could easily have won the final. Gallagher hit the post. Two outstanding saves by Kelleher. The first one in the first half from Palmer was outstanding. But Liverpool were, to make a blindingly obvious point, Liverpool were there for the taking. You know, I mean, they were absolutely, I mean, look at the team sheets. I mean, Chelsea should have got a massive boost before kickoff when they saw just how weakened Liverpool were. Then Moises Chapper Caicedo takes out Gravenberg. They have to rejig things again. Conor Bradley ends up playing the Mo Salah position. And then Liverpool's few experienced players that are fit were absolutely gassed by about minute 75. On come the kids. And Chelsea, in fairness, I thought played well in the closing stages of normal time. Mm. And I'm surprised they didn't score. They did everything but. But extra time, it was so bizarre. And I think Pochettino said afterwards that they were effectively playing for penalties, which is extraordinary because Liverpool, it was such a callow team, filled with teenagers. It was basically held together by that, would you call it a rhombus of Kelleher, Konate, Van Dijk and Endo, all of whom were outstanding throughout. But Chelsea, when they had the chance to win it, just didn't show any interest in doing so. Maybe tried to play in the counter-attack. Definitely seems to be playing for penalties. And honestly, Pochettino looked haunted on the sideline, you know, and it was a really horrible situation for Chelsea, because even if they won it, I don't think there'd be a whole sense of glory. It would be a real sense of relief / avoiding embarrassment. And ultimately, when they were faced with the prospect of that embarrassment, they couldn't avoid it.
As a manager, Shane, like Gav touched on it there, the fact that Pochettino kind of said, do you know what, they're playing for penalties in the second period. How would you approach it? Sometimes as a player, you can sense it on the pitch. Surely they would have sensed how those last few minutes were going. And we can get on to Kelleher's performance in a second and what that might mean for him in the grand scheme of things. But surely as Chelsea players, I don't know, sometimes a manager can say something to you, but surely you have a sense, well, do you know what? Like, these are here. We can take them. Do you know what I mean? Like, you put the pressure on them, especially because they're young kids. They're obviously there for a reason. They're clearly good enough to be in and around the mix. But at that level and on that stage, you put them under pressure, and they looked to be wilting in the second half towards the last few minutes. It looked as if Chelsea had them, they just couldn't score. And then to just totally sit back and just let them play themselves back into it and give them that sense of confidence, it was bizarre.
I thought it was an absolutely flabbergasting approach and even statement to make. I cannot wrap my head around it. I was watching it with my own young lad, and like he at 9 years of age, he was able to make the point that like the 11 players Liverpool don't have on the field would absolutely hammer the shit out of the 11 players that Liverpool do have on the field. Like by that stage, just to emphasise it, by that stage you were looking at Trent, Alisson, Jota, Curtis Jones, Matip, Darwin Nunes, Mo Salah, Szoboszlai, Thiago, Andy Robertson, Gakpo and McAllister.
Who's Thiago? That's your man who does loads of viral clips, isn't it? He's like...
like, that is an incredible list of players not on the field for Liverpool as they headed into extra time. And like, surely that should be the message that he should be hammered, that Pochettino should be hammering home. Listen, like, there's no excuse here for us not finding a way to win this game in the half an hour that we've got to win it. I couldn't believe it. And look, in terms of Neville's comment, like, it's kind of a case here of, well, perception is reality. Like, you know, because like the famous XG will tell you that Chelsea finished higher. Like Chelsea would have won the game on the XG by about half a goal. But he's managed to, you know, that is exactly how everybody will remember this game forever now. It was Klopp's kids against this. And look, they are, it's just hard to believe that they can still be this much of a team of nothingness, almost. You know what I mean? There's still absolutely no identity. There's no stars in the team, with the exception of Cole Palmer. There's all this money spent, and it's still amounts to nothing. Like,
that's the thing. I from a point of view of with Chelsea and with Pochettino, that I'd worry for him, because like as you say, that's it. Like, they haven't gone out and they've gone, obviously spent a fortune, but they haven't got lads who are coming towards the end of their career, like what United have been doing and how United have wasted money. Like, his whole, why he probably would have got the job and why people are thinking he's perfect for it is because of what he's done at Spurs. Like, if Pochettino isn't capable of actually moulding a group of players like this, and not to be, like, challenging for the league already, but to be so far adrift in the Premier League and to be so feeble, essentially, when it mattered in this moment, like, as a manager, like, his kind of whole USP, for want of a kind of better phrase, is being about moulding young lads. Is it being about creating this sense of a team from this, from like what's being thrown together? And like, some of the lads are academy players. This is the thing as well. Like, part of it, like, there's a lot of money being spent. It's not as if as well that he was bringing on in terms of ready-made stars. There was other players, but that's where you're thinking as a coach. Surely by now, like, if you would see more from what he could be doing, because that's what he's supposed to be as a manager, as a coach.
And look, having been so in awe of the job that he did at the club I support, I'm quick enough to shout from the rooftops when I get a prediction right. Like, I don't mind holding my hand up here. I had Chelsea down for Champions League qualification. Absolutely. This season, I thought Chelsea Champions League qualification, the amount of talent that they have there, or what should be talent, what money would dictate must be talent, that they have at the club, and now they've got a manager who was absolutely outstanding as Tottenham manager. I thought this was a no-brainer. Here was a guy who was going to get the most out of these players, and I fancied him to have a right good season, and it's just been an absolute disaster. It's just,
I think he's an absolute goner there, I have to say. Obviously the environment is not set up for success as a manager, let's be honest about it. But certainly, you know, he could have done a lot better than he has done. Like, he has a lot of talent there. He's had no European football. Like, look what Postecoglou has been able to do with a, look, on paper, at least inferior set of players with a similar amount of time to work with them on the training ground. But I think also, and the grain of truth that's in Neville's comment as well, is I think it was a result that shows you that thing, and I don't want to sound like Jake Humphrey here, but like things like culture and attitude do make a difference, and like that's a that's a real signature Klopp win, I think, because you know, like Chelsea, I saw Sky doing this thing where they had this guy arguing back against the narrative, as they called it, that Chelsea had a younger team on the pitch at the beginning and the end by virtue of average age. But it's a different, but it's a whole different ethos and attitude to the younger players. If you're an academy player at Chelsea, you know you're being effectively fattened up for sale. Like, you've not, you know you're there to be, in quotes, pure profit, to fund some young player from elsewhere whom Chelsea might flip for a profit down the line. Whereas Liverpool, now look, Liverpool are far, they're no paupers, and realistically, they will sell some of these academy guys. But these academy guys, when they're coming through, do believe that there's a realistic chance that I'll play for the first team here. And they're empowered to do that. And there's obviously the tactical environment to go into the team, and they know exactly what they're doing. And, you know, Klopp has, over the last few weeks, and especially throughout this tournament, has been kind of clapped on the back by press by saying, oh, fair play to you for giving the young lads a go, as if it's, you know, just a really nice thing for him to do. And every time he responds to it, he says, well, we need them. You know, we can't win this without them. So their young players are really made to feel a part of it. And I think that makes a difference in the end because, okay, Van Dijk wins it from the corner. Liverpool win the corner by James McConnell and Bobby Clark, like really calm in possession and passing the ball around like between the half spaces and in dangerous areas, unbelievably calmly. And Clark wins the corner from which Van Dijk heads it in.
I couldn't agree more, Jake, or I mean, I couldn't agree more, Gav. But on the
you clever fucker.
on the culture point there, like just to come on it, like I suppose at the start of the season, for me, it was a question of will Pochettino's approach and Pochettino's ability to create a culture swallow up Chelsea, or will Chelsea's approach and Chelsea's culture swallow up Pochettino? And I was backing it to be the former, but it's unfortunately turned out to be the latter.
The point as well, like about what you're saying, Gav, about Klopp saying he needs the youngsters. He needs them as well, but also, like, he can turn to them because they're clearly good enough.
Oh, yeah.
At the point where it has come true. Like Alexander-Arnold has come true, Curtis Jones has come true in terms of academy over the last couple of years, because on the last couple of years, and obviously Kelleher, because they're the only ones really since Klopp has been there. They're the ones who are springing to mind. Can't think of any others really who have emerged from the academy. That's why now he's able to do this. He's got a real glut who are clearly good enough. And as you say as well, like, it's going to be a strange one. Like, I reference this, and we can chat about Kelleher now in the piece I wrote. It's like there's different factors at play for all these players now, even for Kelleher. Like, you would think he is primed if he has another month where a big or club will say, you know what, what's at stake, what's being at stake for Liverpool and what's on the line here, and he's delivering. This is a fella who we will spend 30 or 40 million on. Like, he'll be out the door, like, because of FFP. And even with these younger lads, like, if there's bids coming in, especially with a new manager coming, let's be honest, if a new manager coming in, he's going to be a brave, brave fella to stick with young lads rather than wanting something a bit more proven to just eat them. Or, now I'm saying that, or does he stick with them because it might buy him a bit more time where he can say, well, do you know what, this is going to be the future, I believe in these lads, and it might, because it's going to be such a difficult job following Klopp.
Yeah, and here's the thing as well, is before we switch it just purely to Kelleher, maybe, like, it's the absolutely perfect narrative for Klopp, right? Because if Klopp had made this announcement that he was going to leave at the end of the season 12 months ago, the only possible blot on his copybook that could have been thrown at him was, okay, well, what's he leaving us with as he walks out the door? He's had an outstanding team. He's done brilliantly with them. But the next guy in, has he got a whole lot to work with other than, you know, some kind of stars who, you know, some are possibly past their best. Whereas now he's potentially walking out the door and able to say, here you go. I have left you with this fantastic crop of young fellas, and it's just perfect narrative for him.
Yeah. I think he's already called that, hasn't he? He's already said this is, even before some of the younger lads have emerged, but he's already said that this is Liverpool 2.0 in terms of changing from where they were at. And like you see, and this isn't just with the United hat on a little bit, but you see people saying, oh, well, compared to what Ferguson left in Ferguson's last year, but you kind of forget Ferguson built four teams, and you know, we built teams that won three leagues in a row and continually changed. He got to a point where he had one last season and realised, I'm going out here, I want to win the league, he got Van Persie. Mm. Like, it's gas that you see kind of people totally kind of forgetting, well, like what he actually did in the 20 years before that and how often he rebuilt that club. But that's where I think, even from with Klopp's point of view, is that what is important is that he's leaving. You look through maybe the age profile, the likes of, say, Salah and Van Dijk, maybe looking at them possibly around the age of 30, but the other lads there are all mid to late 20s, and then you've got the crop who are early 20s, the likes of, say, the Bradleys, and then you have the younger lads. It seems like the perfect age profile coming through, Gav, for the next manager to assess it and be like, Right, well, there's actually a fair bit here to work with. There's not going to be a huge overhaul.
Oh, the squad's in great shape. You know, it's strong in almost all areas. The age profile, as you rightly say, is really low. So the only real problem the manager, the next Liverpool manager has to deal with is the fact that he's going to be compared to Jurgen Klopp. Mm. I mean, this guy is obviously the best manager in Liverpool's modern history. There's a nice scene with him in the tunnel with Kenny Dalglish in the tunnel after they won the cup final. And in terms of that stretch from Shankly to Dalglish, like, he's right in amongst them. Like, what he has done is incredible. And that's why I think that Carabao Cup final will be really fondly remembered in the club's history. Because obviously, like, you know, it's such a tiny little trophy, even like physically in stature. I wish it was a bit bigger. But it'll feel a lot bigger in Liverpool's history just because the context in which they won. And Klopp saying things like it's the most special trophy he ever won. Mm-hmm. And like, again, like when Klopp says this stuff, you kind of have to believe him because he clearly believes it himself. It's a signature win just because it spoke to a whole culture and ethos and ambition that he's instilled at the club overall. And obviously Liverpool are, you know, well run, and they've got great people in every department. But trust me, like, none of it happens without Klopp. And it's really, like, obviously sometimes we talk about how we overstate the role of the manager when we slag him off for everything that goes wrong and praise him for everything that goes right. But then when you see the job done that well, you are reminded that even in the world of head coach and sporting directors and transfer committees and chief scouts and so forth, the manager is still almost frighteningly important to a club.
He's on the ground with them every day. He's the one who sees players and gets to know players and their characteristics. And like, as you're saying, like Shane, a good manager will be able to sniff when lads are ready, when lads are not, when maybe they could be struggling. Isn't that? That's like, you can't get away from that. It's mad. Like, even this whole discourse about, even you see now what's happening with, say, United and getting the likes of, like, trying to get Ashworth and stuff. Like, it's gas. But like, the difference in like 10, 12 years just shows you how football has changed in terms of, say, the structures. Where it was seen as, if you had a director of football, that's undermining the manager. Mm. The manager, Ferguson always said, the manager has to be the one who's the most powerful. Like, he has to be the one who's the most powerful within that squad. The worst thing is if the director of football is there, is kind of almost like almost a conduit with players that enter the ownership that then undermines the manager. It all has to work together, but the most important person still has to be that manager. He has to be the one, because he's the one who's, as I was saying, has to have that kind of connection with his players to know what's right at certain times.
Yeah, you could argue that the manager has to be the most important person around the dressing room and the training ground, but is the director of football potentially still the most important person at the club? I don't know if it's quite that balanced, but yeah, look, when you have impressive people in both roles, that's when you're striking goals, you know.
Mm. And even with Kelleher now, like, we've touched on it, but you can't, like, if Klopp was staying on, you'd be thinking, right, use this as your way of a springboard to go, because you can tell, like, obviously, like, even with the Becker, Alisson's contract is until what, I think it's still 2027. I don't think he's gone anywhere. He still seems to be at the top of his game. I know he's had maybe a couple of injuries and maybe a bit this year, but it just seems obvious now that putting a really strong month or so, he's probably going to have to come out of the team. But he might have done enough then to have a platform to go on and get a much bigger move in the summer.
Yeah, and the bit, it's gas, David, the bit, I'm at an age now where you kind of, you know, when you're hitting your early 40s and you want time to stand still, and time seems to be disappearing quicker than you would have wanted. I just rocked back when you said he was 25. I just did not have it in my head that he was 25 already.
He's the same age as Alisson was when Liverpool.
Yeah, that was the point you made, which was a really good point. Like, I was just, I don't know, I'm kind of stuck in a time warp. I still had it in my head that he was, you know, coming into his early 20s. Yeah, like, he is absolutely now at an age where you can't possibly, you know. Who did I see? I saw somebody threw it up on Twitter, did they? I saw somebody on social media saying, why would he want to be anywhere else? Like, let's be realistic here. He can't go back to being a regular number two after what he showed over the last few weeks. It can't happen. He's done too well. There's going to be too many clubs after him. His value is going to have gone up. And they, look, I can't see any other outcome here than he ends up at another club, because, as you've said, Alisson isn't going anywhere for a few years yet, and he's probably in the top three keepers in the world, as highly and all as we rate Kelleher. So what's the only outcome?
And even with that, guy as well, again, it comes back to the fact there's going to be a new manager coming in. Now, this is the thing. Again, we've kind of said it with the youngsters. A new manager will come in and say, well, do you know what? Like, what does, if you're a new manager coming in, what does Kelleher do differently or better? Or is there to Alisson that could say, well, do you know what? I'm gonna go with him instead. Because again, it's gonna take an unbelievably brave decision to come in and change that goalkeeper situation. Because it's not something, there's so many, there could be other things that need to change ahead of that, mate.
No, I don't. For as long as Alisson's there, he'll be number one. Certainly, at least in these peak years of his career. As great as Kelleher is, I think Carragher's main line of praise to him is just like, I can't praise him any higher than say it's as if Alisson is in goals today. So that'll give you a sense as to how Alisson is number one. So for Kelleher, I mean, I'm sure he's really sick of hearing everyone talk about why he should be somewhere else. I think he's answered back as to why he shouldn't be. He scored the winning penalty kick in the Carabao Cup final 2 years ago and has made two massive saves and won the fans' man of the match this time. But that's an unbelievable Irish sporting achievement. Like the level, people underestimate the level that he is playing at there. I know people will go, oh, it's only the Carabao Cup. But, you know, it is a domestic trophy in England, which is the most competitive football environment on the planet. So what he's done is incredible, you know. So I would expect that with Klopp moving, with that sense of turnover that will come to the club this summer, that does feel the right time to move on. I think he's proven with this run in the team that he's good enough to be a number one elsewhere in the Premier League. But he is a massive, like he will have a massive say in this season yet, because Alisson is out until April. Like Kelleher is going to be in goals against Manchester City, and Liverpool, I think, basically have to win that game if they're going to win the league. So if Liverpool do go on to win the league this season, Kelleher will have played a massive role in doing that. I think he's already won, is it 5 major trophies at Liverpool? Or 6, maybe? Like, I mean, there's guys who played week in, week out for Liverpool throughout the 2000s who didn't reach that total. Like, I mean, what he's done already is brilliant. The best thing for Ireland is that he goes and plays regularly. But what a luxury he is for Klopp and Liverpool to have him at number two. And if Xabi Alonso comes in or whoever else does come in, I'm sure they will be keen themselves to keep Kelleher as number two.
We've spoken there about Klopp and managing and just kind of reference there, just about kind of understanding what can be best for players. That kind of brings us on into what De Zerbi was saying about Evan Ferguson. So obviously after the game, he came off injured, I think about a knock with about 16 minutes to go. And he was just kind of asked about it in his post-match press conference.
It's good. I think he's not spending the best period of his time. But we can help him. We can understand him because he's very young. I think he can play better. I think the team needs Evan on his 100% of physical condition, mental condition. Yes, I think he played well, but in so small spaces in the last 20 minutes, 10 minutes, I thought Adam Lallana could be more important than Evan.
So this is where, this week, we knew this day would come. We always knew it, Shane. Gav, we've spoken so positively about him, but there was always going to be this moment where things weren't going great for Evan Ferguson.
Yeah, but what do people expect? There is no way that people's trajectory just goes in an upward curve the whole time without any hiccups, without any periods where you're questioned or where you're not performing to the level that people think you're capable of doing. Like, that was always going to happen. And again, not to be blowing smoke at you too much, but your article kind of nails it, you know. I also don't think De Zerbi's been too hard on him. I see a lot of people coming out and saying, oh, you know, De Zerbi's been really tough on him here and I don't think he's the right manager for him and he needs to get out of there where he has a manager who's got more faith in his abilities, all this kind of crack. Like, I don't buy into that. I think having watched, you know, either all of or parts of Evan Ferguson's performances for Brighton of late, if Evan Ferguson was a run-of-the-mill English-born player, I would be saying, yeah, He's not really performing at the moment. And you would struggle to put forward an argument that he should be getting more playing time than he's getting. But you can say that and also still say that Evan Ferguson has as much ability and potential as we have all been saying for a long time, and I believe is going to go on and be an absolute star of the game for us as a country, and at least at the top half of Premier Division level. He's just gone through a difficult period, and thankfully, what we know of him and what we know of what surrounds him, he is the sort of fella who, rather than throwing a sulk during a difficult period, is likely to learn some lessons that will be massively beneficial for him going forward.
And it's even, Gab, as well, it's someone to talk, obviously, about him. It's what kind of would influence it is just by speaking to people about him as well. Like, people who maybe work with footballers and work in and around and have worked with him and see him. That's the reason why people are getting more excited. And it's part of the reason, we said this even last year, why he's in the team, is just because he has shown, like, you know, De Zerbi has mentioned there, say, maybe mentally he's not right. Again, that's all to do with, you would imagine as well, to do with confidence. It's amazing what a goal might do for that. But it's like, it's like the point I'm trying to make is, you know, two things could be right at the same time. It's not as if you have to go from one extreme to the other, just assessing because, you know, there's been a bit of criticism now of him. Or not even criticism, but just bringing up a point that, well, do you know what, he actually is in a bit of a slump here now and just needs to kind of try and get through it. And that's where, as well, De Zerbi has to kind of help him too, and himself.
Yeah, for sure. I think I can't believe people are saying, like, get him out of Brighton, etc. Brighton is a brilliant environment for him, both in terms of continuing his technical development, but also just, like, you know, it being in the Brighton team at that age means you're allowed to have this. You know, if you're at Manchester United and leading the line, you're getting so much stick and there's so much noise, and that architecture really isn't around the club to protect you in the way it is at Brighton. Like, I think he'll be absolutely fine. I think this is completely normal for such a young player who really did burst on the scene last year to go through a challenging time in terms of form. He hasn't been playing every minute. Like, okay, people will point to it's been a while since his last goal, as you point out in your piece. But at the same time, like, Brighton have not been the same team. You know, they've been missing Mitoma and Adingra out wide. They've had to play in recent weeks with James Milner and Gross there. There's just no pace there. So it's so much harder. Like, their entire attacking output has fallen. João Pedro takes the bloody penalties. Just give them to Evan Ferguson. He seems to have a couple of them a game. He's in a relatively poor run of form here at the moment, but I don't think it's any cause for concern. And I think, David, from, like, we've both done pieces where we've talked to people about Ferguson and we've always kind of inquired about him, and I think both of us will have heard the same thing, that, you know, what's his best characteristic? That he's just the same fella that walked through here a few years ago. That he's just one of the lads, that he's not changed at all, and that his feet are on the ground. So that makes it so much easier to deal with what's going with this little slightly sticky run of form now, that he didn't get completely carried away with himself when he was scoring a hat-trick against Newcastle and there was the eyes of the world on him, and thinking, well, actually, that's now my level, and I need to feed on that level of hype and praise every week. He doesn't, you know, he'll be absolutely fine. Obviously, this is a sticky run of form. I still think he's in Brighton's best 11, but obviously Roberto De Zerbi maybe disagrees, and there are plenty of absentees, including Pedro, at the weekend. But it's interesting, but I don't think it's anything that was entirely unforeseen, and I would still be pretty confident that he'll make it out of it.
And just to continue on then, on that theme of managers and players and just how you deal with them differently, like, after, on this is obviously turning it just to League of Ireland, after Shelbourne beat Rovers and McGrovers 2-1 on Friday, I thought it was interesting just to hear Duff. You kind of have this, you have this perception of Damien Duff just from down the years, and even how he speaks himself, he always talks about demands and what he puts on players. But we spoke to him after the game about Will Jarvis. Like, if people haven't seen the goal yet, it's worth just having a search for it on the League of Ireland's YouTube page, because it's up there. Like, the touch out of the air is just superb. He's obviously, he's like, was he 21 or 20, 21? He's on loan from Hull. It's his second stint. But you're going to ask him about Will Jarvis after the game, and it was just an interesting one from Duff, just to talk about how he's kind of forcing him to be a bit different as a manager. So just have a listen to this real quick.
He's a joke, yeah. He's a strange cat. It probably took him, the lads, maybe when he was here the first time, a few weeks to warm to him, because he's, you probably just need to meet him. Now, Will, he's just so laid back. He's on the floor. Like, so even me as a manager, as a coach, the way I'm built, it's like you're on it every day in training, but he's not. And
I have to kind of bite my lip and just accept that maybe he's one of them players. Well, he is one of them players. Okay, he doesn't probably train particularly well, a bit like Liam Burt, but Friday night they stand up. So, yeah, brilliant goal. It's not where, like, he's sitting on the deck chair on the side, but yeah, we've all come across them. I remember Berbatov of Fulham. It's just his demeanour, the way he is. It probably won't help him at other places. That's why we're tailor-made for him. We know how to manage him. He settled in. He's part and parcel. He loves it here. He couldn't wait to come back, which I felt very proud about, because every guy, they come here and they play for whatever, 4 or 5 months, they want to go back to the UK and stay there. He wanted to come back. So maybe it's how we deal with him, or letting him away with training shit. I don't know. But I think it's there for him to see tonight what a top player is, and he's only half fit as well, which is the scary thing. He hasn't had a pre-season. Maybe the last time I did it was maybe at Celtic. I remember Odson Edward and Rodgick, and they come out and they're wonderful players, but they're, you know, a bit calm, and I'd be having a shift and they're probably looking at me, who's this crazy Irish guy? So you take little bits along the way, and maybe from working with the likes of them, I'm looking at Will, go, okay, yeah. But absolutely, if it's 15, 17, Evan Caffrey will tell you, 6:30 in the morning, you're not running. When I was at Roadstone with him, you're getting it. But you deliver on a Friday, I might turn a blind eye at times to Will.
So Shane, as a coach, I'm sure you can actually relate to that, I would say, in terms of seeing people or having worked with people who ordinarily you would not want to have anywhere near your starting 11, because they're an absolute nightmare to work with maybe on a day-to-day basis, but you know are capable of winning you a match.
Yep, 100%. Look, it's one of those old kind of cliche lines that you'll get, you know, occasionally you'll get players who will say, look, all you want is a manager who treats everybody the same, you know, impossible. You absolutely can't treat everybody the same. Or, you know, all you want is, this manager is great because, you know, he just demands so much of people. And if you're not putting it in every training session, if you're not putting it in every game, if you're not working hard off the ball, he won't pick you. Well, the same manager wouldn't have picked Cristiano Ronaldo in his entire career then. Do you know what I mean? Like, unfortunately, there are, or fortunately, depending on which way you look at it, there are very, very, very different personalities that make up a dressing room. And you put them into those categories of, look, in a dreamland, you want, in your dressing room, you want as many players who are low maintenance and high output, all right? But I'll tell you now, David, they are rare. The low maintenance, high output boys are rare. And yet that's why you absolutely love them when you get them. What you'll most commonly get is fellas who fall into either of two categories: low maintenance but relatively low output, or not you know, not massively eye catching output, if that makes sense, or high output, high maintenance. All right.
Go on. Who's the prima donna?
Ah, sure. Listen, nearly every. I'm telling you now, nearly every best player that I have had at any of my clubs in the League of Ireland, inevitably, at each club I've been at, they were probably the hardest to manage. Again, I've said it before.
Shane, no need to name names, but what's the maddest thing you've done to keep a high-maintenance player happy?
To keep a high-maintenance player happy, what's the maddest thing I've done? I can't. You're looking for a headline here. I probably can't give you something mental. Like, the big thing here, to be honest with you, is nearly more so the management of the rest of the group's perception of how you're handling that player rather than actually how you're handling that player. Because it's all well and good me deciding that, you know, I need to treat this guy a little bit differently, I need to give him a little bit more leeway. Like, the key determining factor there in whether that works or whether that doesn't work is the player will be happy, but the key determining factor here is how the rest of the dressing room perceive that. And that's, you know, look, the obviously I had Jack at Cove, I had Danny at Wexford, you know, my Ronan Murray was probably my top performer at Dundalk. Yeah, to be honest with you, there would have even been a little bit of leeway there with him, but it probably would have been more so down to his body and his inability to do as much training maybe as the others. But, you know, let's be honest here, at Cove Ramblers, there's no point me saying otherwise, you probably won't mind me saying, I would have had a captain in Jason Abbott who would have said, look, Shane, you have your hands full with him there, we're behind you. We know that you have to treat him slightly differently, and you know we understand that. So long as he keeps delivering for us on the pitch, we're happy enough with how you're handling him. And the same at Wexford, I would have had a scenario where basically Danny Furlong's strike partner Aidan Keenan would have said, "Listen, Shane, just tell Danny to stay up near the goal. I'll do his work and my work between me or on my own, and let him just keep scoring the goals that win us titles." You know, and that's it was brilliant to hear Duffer saying it publicly, though, because as David has said, you know, there is this perception that, oh, you get away with nothing with Duffer and you won't be in Duffer's team unless you're absolutely putting it in. So it was great to hear such an example such as him come out and say, no, we all have to do this a little bit here and there.
Yeah. Well, the point, it was interesting, the second point you got now, but the with that answer that Duff gave, the kind of the last maybe few seconds of that was more so in relation to a question that was asked about how you have to treat lads differently from when he was working as a youth team coach. That's why he referenced Caffrey to a senior player, because obviously when they're senior players, you have to say, well, do you know what, they're the professional they are, and you have to work within the kind of the framework of where they are. Whereas when they're younger, that's when you mould them, that's when you're on them, and that's when you don't have that leeway. Do you know what I mean? So that's the interesting point, is that he clearly has realised and you would expect any coach, any manager, anybody in any walk of life, as you get older, when you have to look after people and stuff, of just realising that.
Yeah, no, that's such an interesting insight that I never really considered before. But I was just really going to add to Shane's point that it can be, you know, theoretically, I think you always think that the best environment for a successful football team is, you know, 11 equals who are working unbelievably hard for themselves and for each other. But as you point out, it can often be completely inspiring when 10 people are like, this guy is so much better than us. Let's work for him. Argentina, the World Cup, with Messi being the obvious one. I mean, obviously, Messi didn't do any running at all. Louis van Gaal pointed that out before the quarterfinal. And Alexis McAllister just told the Netflix series after the World Cup that, huge mistake, Van Gaal, you made Messi angry. So, like, the Argentina players, listen to this, entirely a valid criticism from Van Gaal. And we're like, we got to work harder.
So. We actually got up this morning, myself and Connor, and a clip came up on my phone of, it's like 30 years, is it? 1994, that is 30 years ago, isn't it? Yeah, 30 years ago today since Matt Letizia scored that free kick where the ball was rolled back to him and he flips it up and just volleys it up into the top corner. And Connor's seen a few.
Oh, yeah. Did he really?
That nearly flew over my head there for a minute.
Maybe the shot really did fly over even the goal. I mean, who knows with social media? How can you? You could be kind of chewing on gummies watching that and off your head. You don't know what's going on.
But he's seen a few different clips of Letizia here and there over the last few years, and he was on to me this morning. Was he a star for England? Like, as I trying to explain, no, why not? Because at Southampton, you had 10 fellas who were willing to absolutely be completely subservient to one man, but that works at certain levels and doesn't work at other levels. And even again, going back to Wexford, that's where, you know, it would have worked for me with Danny in the first division. In the Premier Division, it kind of had to take a different approach because you kind of don't get away with that. It's all about levels, really, in that sense, you know.
You said there about subservience to one man. That's how the FA used to be run when John Delaney was in charge.
What a segue.
Listen, come here. What can I say? I don't think it's quite as bad as that is now, Gavin. But obviously, you've been there for, you were obviously in Leinster House last week. You covered the Public Accounts Committee. And let's be honest, it just completely has overshadowed and taken away so much of the debate that could have been there about Mark Cannon's the Player Pathways Plan and where that was going and the talk that should have been there, and the FA wanted to even talk about the betting levy and how what the money that could have an impact on. Like, again, I wrote about how obviously there was loads of jokes flying around and redacted listen, we were all doing it and stuff, but step away from it, there's a lot of anger there now as well.
Oh, massive anger among staff, among everyone in football, and I think it's justified. What happened on Thursday was attributed to a joke, is a joke in many ways, but no one's laughing because too many people have been at the butt of this for too long. That the FAI are rightly asking the government for hundreds of million euro of investment and are then asked to do one thing by them, to send in an email chain, to validate what the CEO said about a holiday payment in Leinster House last December, and that they can't send those emails on time, that they only land at 11:30 the night before and are therefore not read by some politicians and committee members until 45 minutes before proceedings get underway. And then the key email to that is entirely redacted, including the time and date and the FAI's own postal address. That is unbelievable. That the FAI, the most important thing for the FAI here is to keep the government on side. You know, they've done, in my view, quite a good job in a number of ways of, you know, overhauling the organisation and making all the governance changes, all that boring, dreary stuff that I'm sure that a lot of people in the FAI have put a lot of hard work into. Really dull stuff that doesn't get any credit from the outside world. But they've done all that. And now they've massively undermined it all by, I spoke to someone in the FAI over the weekend, a staffer, and in their words, we gave two fingers to the government by submitting emails late and that were entirely redacted. Like the FAI, okay, this is the whole explanation for the holiday pay to Hill now, is that he didn't ask for it. He made a throwaway line, a joke, in an email to a junior employee who was then interpreted as a formal request by the former finance director, and all of a sudden the money landed in his account. Now, there were some committee members who didn't believe that. Alan Dillon said it wasn't credible. Paul McAuliffe called it pretty unbelievable. But if you are going to expect people to believe that, then why redact the line that you're happy to read out into the record? Can you negotiate the same for me, please? ! This was the joke upon which the whole thing began. So the FAI stopped short of absolute transparency there, and in my view, they were wrong. Their reasoning for it was they wanted to protect the identity of the junior employee, and hence why they redacted the email. I think I respect that, but as the chairman, Brian Stanley, said, why not? Why was it not sufficient just to retract the name of the employee themselves? I think the FAI were right. The FAI are entirely fair to seek legal advice around that. But at some stage, the leaders of the organisation, specifically the chief executive, has to say, yes, of course we should protect this employee's identity. But at the same time, we have to protect the reputation of the FAI in the view of the most important people in the country, who are those who are going to potentially fund the game's development here for the next 15 years. Mm-hmm. And they just got that balance completely wrong. And while they were, okay, fair enough, protect the identity of the junior employee. Now, my understanding is that is also a former employee. There were no efforts made to protect the identity of the former finance director, Alex O'Connell, who had his name kicked around the dole for hours and wasn't there to explain himself or defend himself. A guy who's moved on from the FAI having done an impressive job in unbelievably difficult circumstances after the John Delaney era ended in 2019, and he found himself kind of suddenly sprung up to a senior position there. So it was an utterly dispiriting day out. The FAI were made to look amateurish, were made to look disrespectful of the government. And another thing in where they stop short of absolute transparency, which is what the FAI, what should be demanded of the FAI, is the fact that Alex O'Connell and Aoife Rafferty, the HR director, were both invited there and didn't attend. And the chairman, Tony Keohane, the FAI chairman, did seem to suggest that it was the FAI board who decided that they wouldn't go, that they felt the people there were the appropriate people to talk about it. It was a dispiriting day, and it was one which undermines the FAI's progress that has been made, and also massively undermines its reputation in the eyes of the people who will fund it. So if I was working with the FAI, I'd be absolutely furious about it.
And the issue as well, Shane and Gav, for both, like, this obviously happened last week, but the ramifications for this are going to be, we've said it, like, the FAI are 100% correct in terms of with the infrastructure plan, the pathways plan, we feel, in terms of where football needs to go. But with that email and how it was, even just the optics of how it was kind of, like, held up as this kind of almost like, I just going to describe it as a reverse gotcha. Surely they knew this was coming, and yet they couldn't see, like, this whole, the organisation was supposed to be changing, and it was supposed to be more open and transparent on the back of what happened previously under John Delaney. That was the whole remit of coming in and putting things on an even keel and just making the people know that this is an organisation that can be trusted going forward. And yet now, you need political will and political people to be able to usher through the change that is so badly required. And yet, anybody who doesn't want to see that now has the perfect excuse.
Yeah,
they can literally say, well, what has changed?
Yeah, I'm nowhere near as educated in this whole area as Gav is, to be honest with you. And it just, not that it bores the life out of me, it just frustrates life out of me. It just seems to be groundhog fucking day, really, to be honest with you.
And that's the issue, sorry, but that's the issue as well, Shane, is that people are getting worn down by the same stuff over and over. So like you, who's been involved in Irish football and obviously would be involved in Gaelic games, but it's like this, it's the fact that issues like this are continually wearing down people, good people, who are the ones who suffer from this. So people end say, well, do you know what's changing? We're going to walk away. We're not going to get involved. We're going to focus our energies somewhere else. So like that kind of almost apathy will seep through because it comes down from the top.
Yep.
And there's no getting away from that. That's why this is so frustrating. And like Gab mentioned it there about obviously you have your legal advice and all the rest of it. But like if you haven't got the basic awareness and cop on of what that would look like to present a fully redacted email about an email chain, regardless of if you're trying to protect someone, it's very easy to protect someone's identity and still be open about something. There was only one person that was trying to protect.
Yeah. And for it all to happen in the same week as the launch of the Pathways plan, it's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable because, like, I you know, I've been semi-outspoken on one issue around the Pathways plan, but by and large, I find it to be a really, really good document and very impressive. There's an awful lot of stuff in it that I would be massively on board with and think there's some brilliant ideas in there. But again, the vast majority of what's in there is going to obviously rely on improved financing and like not all that we need to do. It makes it sound simple, but like, we just need to present ourselves with a clean bill of health here when we're going looking for these funds. And we're just completely incapable of doing that. Which is, as I say, frustration is the only emotion, the consistent overriding emotion.
Now, Shane, it wouldn't be right, in fairness, to say that the FAI have shot themselves in the foot here. I think what would be correct to say is the FAI took the gun, pointed it at their foot, put the finger on the trigger, but then the trigger appears to have interpreted that as a formal suggestion or a formal request to start opening fire.
I did see you make that comment somewhere and got quite a laugh over that, right? Yeah.
Couple of other quick things on this pack thing before we move off it, because it's too, you despair if you talk about it for too long. Obviously, the big headline out of it was Paul Cook, the president, saying that his confidence in Jonathan Hill has been challenged. Now, the FAI did take communications advice from an external firm prior to this. Now, why the FAI, who have a communications department, need further communications advice that they're spending, I'm sure, a not insignificant amount of money on, I'm not so sure. And how on earth that communications advice then led to the disaster we saw unfold is very, very curious. But I would assume, now I'm only going off assumptions here, that the communications advice would have included A, present a united front, and B, you will be asked at some point to express confidence in the CEO. If the FAI president or, you know, significant members of the board don't have confidence in the CEO, say that behind closed doors. Because if you bring that out into the open, it actually further undermines the image of the FAI. You know, that's the kind of, not to use too much football speak, but keep that, that's dressing room stuff, you know, keep that there rather than break that out into the open. Because now what we're going to end up with is loads more talk about FAI politics and manoeuvres and so forth. And again, it just distracts from the real issue and just reinforces all the old terrible views of the FAI as, you know, Michael Nugent's perpetually exploding clown car, or Declan Lynch's the Galacticos, the dysfunctional organization, whom other dysfunctional organizations call the Galacticos. It's a joke. It was a joke of a day.
And I'm saying it's a joke of a day. Well, tomorrow is Tuesday. It's our favorite Tuesday of the month. Why is that, Gav?
Oh, is it a board meeting day? Don't say.
I think the last one was supposed to be some recommendations for where the Irish manager's job was at. That's when, wasn't it? That was when it was kind of almost like an induction day as well for the new board. You mentioned talking about it. And a month ago they were saying an appointment was imminent for the new senior men's manager. That, you said, talking about United Front, the Pathways plan, it seemed to be, again, that was the kind of the message, you know, with it's close, it's close. We've both been talking to people, we talk about kind of stuff being kept in the background, and there is stuff happening in the background that you kind of know what's going on a little bit, but you don't get the sense that it is imminent, I'll be honest. Or if it is imminent, it's not where they want it to be, that they might end up falling to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, if I do wonder if things were very, very close on Friday or Saturday, would the names have come out, or the name have come out, just because it would have been a good distraction, obviously, from the disaster at PAC. Mark Hannum said that they're following a similar process to the one which led Eileen Gleeson to be appointed. That took 15 weeks. We're in week 14 now, so that is potentially consistency there. Some people at the FAI were telling me last week that they expected something next week, which means this week. I don't know why I phrased that so awkwardly. So we suppose we have to, it is possible, and obviously things have been kept very tight. We can only tell you who's not in the running at this point rather than who is.
But that's the thing with this as well, is like people say about like, oh, they expect something to happen. That's because maybe that's what they're being told, but it's a very, very tight kind of crew of people here who are in the know here, essentially, of where it is at. And we're saying there about kind of Turo, even with some of the other kind of appointments that have been happening even behind the scenes, the less glamorous stuff that around, say, like kind of staff and all, and people coming in and getting interviewed and stuff, like some of that has rubbed up people the wrong way. You know, there's no getting away from it.
Things are very slow moving under this organisation, I think, or under this executive. Obviously, Stephen Kenny's contract announcement took a long time to finalise. We're talking months from the time that Jonathan Hill told, I think it might have been the General Assembly delegates that he was going to, that, you know, that the move was to renew it. Jim Crawford's contract extension went on for so long that his contract lapsed. Mad. You know, we saw the Eileen Gleeson thing take 15 weeks. So, you know, if they're deliberate and they take their time and they get the candidate they want, all will be well with the world. But yeah, I like, hopefully we're all put out of our misery and there's an appointment soon. This whole thing is dragging on for so long. I know we were, myself and yourself, David, have spent most of our last few weeks finding out names and trying to stand them up and so forth. And we're just getting as far.
You're actually now in one of my top three favourites on WhatsApp just from kind of recent thing. Normally we can go 1 week to next, maybe just the odd Slack message and stuff. But like, I almost sent you a gift that I meant to send to my wife.
The betting list also reflects the fact that there's so little info out there. I mean, our boy Anthony Hudson is now third favourite, despite the fact that his name first emerged when we reported that he was out of the running. I mean, that goes to show.
But that also shows you, and you'd be getting that as well. But this is the thing, even people within football, and you know, Shane, but even within football, people would be saying, oh, he's favourite now. X and Y has gone nil. These are people within football who know how it works. I was like, yeah, but that can just be like a random fellow who's had 3 points deciding to put on £100 on someone.
I know.
Or on their phone.
And yet I still find it interesting. I do end up finding myself, and obviously they'd pulled the market down completely during all last week's crack of will there be an announcement in the next 24 hours? Will there not? Is it going to be a temporary announcement? Is it going to be a permanent one? So I do look, just out of interest and for the crack, I do find myself checking it every now and again. In my efforts to try and find a left field name that I think is both, you know, potentially a good option and actually realistic and something that Monday Night Football last week is
don't say
Coach Marsh. Coach Marsh.
Is Jesse Marsh too high profile for us? Would he say no to the Ireland job?
I think he's too high profile for us. I think he could get a better job than the Ireland job, to be honest.
He probably could. Couldn't
I? I think he'd be great.
Oh no, I genuinely, I that is one I would like to see.
Although he did use the phrase, he's a very impressive speaker, I have to say. I assume he's been on the High Performance Podcast. If not, I mean, Humphrey might make him co-host because he's so, he really does talk in that way. But I remember that he was talking about our man Paddy McCarthy at Palace, and he was talking about the job of the interim manager. And he used the phrase, his task is to make today's game as congruent with the past as is possible. And Carragher honestly looked like he was about to have a stroke.
That's another one of those ones where I need to grab the dictionary, yeah.
Well, Shane, we'll leave you be to go to your dictionary corner, and we can come back next week. And
will we have a manager? Does anyone expect us to have a manager by the next pod?
I actually think, and this is probably something I should wait for us to finish up and say, but your listener say it anyway. The fact that we keep getting hijacked by pack talk and Irish manager talk, I still don't think we've delved deep enough into this pathways plan. I would love for us to do a bit of a special around that, because Gav's piece was really good on it. And I think as a document, it's like there's so many talking points within the document. And I think it's something that has, I would argue, more real interest or effect on the Irish football public than both pack or possibly even who the next Irish manager is.
Yeah. Well then how about that then? That's what we will do. We're obviously, as you say, like it's going to be happening over the next little while in terms of with the manager, because like what we know, 26th of February, there's matches in a month's time. So like there's going to be literally provisional squads getting worked on now, by for the senior team. an appointment or a decision one way or another is going to be imminent. Once that is sorted, we'll obviously chat and hopefully convene as one, go through it and genuinely have a proper chat about it.
Brilliant.
Yep. Sounds good.
No worries, lads. Take care. Have a good week.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers, lads.